it's one of those things where at 30,000 feet, they look really similar. Because at 30,000 feet, you're technically, like, if you think about both spaces, you technically have some like raw data, like a PST or a bunch of files from a file share. So you have this data, and then you have to like normalize it, which oftentimes people call processing, but you got to get it to where you can like search and interact with it. You've got to like ideally reduce the data set to the relevant stuff. You've got to make decisions on it, and then like a deliverable comes out. So at 30,000 feet, those two things sound similar.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Happy to have you on the show, Adi. Really excited to have a chat with you. You know, hear a lot about your sort of data expertise and I guess we'll just jump right into it. Just for the audience, why don't you go ahead and tell us about yourself and your company?
Sure. I'm Adi Elliott. I'm the COO of Canopy Software. And we make the world's only data mining, data breach response specific software. And my background is I got into it via eDiscovery, like a lot of people. So I like founded the marketing and enterprise sales teams at a company called Relativity that became kind of the leader in the e-discovery space. And that was a journey in a lot of ways of making transitions from like local software to database software. And it was a really interesting time in e-discovery. And then worked on the service provider space in e-discovery. And that company that I worked for got bought by a company called Epic, which also plays in our space. And I led strategy there. Mm-hmm. Which all was an interesting background to where somebody played matchmaker between me and Ralph Nickel, Canopy CEO and founder. So Essentially, I guess my responsibilities is really the business side of the house, and then some other back office stuff, obviously. But yeah, our software, it's a really interesting space because of how the industry has evolved in the last few years.
I guess before we jump into that and some of the history. What kind of geographies maybe are you focused on? Is there anything, maybe I put it a different way, you know, with kind of you guys doing a lot in tools, perhaps it could be any geography. Where do you see a lot of demand geographically? Where are you really working a lot now?
Yeah, it's US, Canada, UK, Australia, and to some degree Europe too. Although I would say like Australia is much bigger than people realize. Especially post Optus, and they've had some big events there. But in general, Australia was already a pretty big market for us. We just hired someone from our customer success team actually in Australia not too long ago. Everywhere, okay. Like the English speaking regulatory world where people value privacy is generally a pretty good fit. Although there's like I said, There's stuff coming out of GDPR in Europe as well. I think in general, I would say. The interesting confluence of it all is that almost simultaneously, all of these countries realize that it's like good politics, but also a reasonable thing to protect the PII and the personal data of all of us as individuals. So really, the demand came in all of these places at kind of the same time. And it's one of those use cases where without like the ability of cloud software now, I don't think we'd be able to service it in the same way. We were able to kind of scale globally almost instantaneously.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, we Aceris launching when it did, you know, sort of, I don't want to say kind of in the middle of COVID really was, you know, by the time we fully launched, it was pretty similar. Like, you know, you have sort of cloud software, you can keep data in a lot of different countries, you know, you don't have to go over borders. And you can scale really, really quickly.
It's wild from a business perspective to see it firsthand, because, and again, I'll juxtapose it to my early days in e-discovery in like the mid to late 2000s. There, everyone had to install this stuff on local servers, and you had to cut like huge checks for just to like Dell to like install all your stuff and pick. And everyone was saying they did DR, but they didn't really. Like, no one really did DR back in the like. It was just too. It was so expensive to. And some people would be secretly running it in like a closet in their office or something.
Right.
And there was like no way one of these companies was going to all of a sudden be in Australia because it's just not possible. The investment, you have to have people there, you have to have servers there. It's wild to see all these years later, the difference between like 2008 and like today, how companies scale and how fast that happens.
Yeah, I think cloud has been has definitely been an interesting shift. I guess you had sort of the normal, you know, increase in capacity. I was just thinking about it as I was looking at iPhones, and they come up to a terabyte now. You just think you can have a terabyte in your phone. Yeah. You know, I guess it was always going to happen, but amount of space. Yeah, it's all because, you know, you have the massive camera that's generating, you know, gigabytes worth of video or of giant photos. But yeah, it has been pretty neat starting with that sort of concept of you know, cloud everywhere, you know, and with COVID it changed a lot where it became like people everywhere. You can hire people wherever they are, and kind of work around a lot of things, expand quickly. You know, you have these companies that help you expand into new markets really, really quickly. You know, so when there's demand in whatever country, you can get there and you can get boots on the ground so much easier than what I could do even 3-4 years ago.
So it's interesting because it kind of is like, I would say Canopy is one of those companies that it's not even possible without cloud. And the reason I say that is because like the demand, like getting to your question about geographies, the demand was in all these places simultaneously. Mm. Like it was like Australia and Canada and the US and the UK and Europe all simultaneously were like regulating more strongly. We're like saying, hey, if these compromise events happen, you got to like find out whose data it is and notify them.
Yeah.
And for us, what was interesting is like there was nothing that solved that problem when we came on the scene. Like there was just, so everyone was like putting together bubble gum and duct tape and just like really adapting e-discovery tech to try and shoehorn in the solution. And they'd usually have like workarounds before and workarounds after. But if you think about it, for like the amount of investment it would have taken to found Canopy without cloud software is we would have had to like build out all these geographies and like from an infrastructure standpoint, if I think like how we would have done it back in the day and how we would have deployed would have been totally different. It would have been a much harder lift and it would have been much harder to even capitalize on the market, to even provide a solution. It's one of those like things that is only possible because of that. But it really, the demand, if you think about it, what's kind of cool is like Canopy as a company couldn't have existed 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you this, it's kind of related to this. So just kind of maybe size of clients, we talk a bit about geographies. Are there kind of maybe between the different geographies or between different sizes of clients, are you seeing differences in notifications? Like, who basically, I guess, is sort of using your software a lot? What kind of clients?
So I would say there's like four groups that use our software, though two of them are like primaries. So I would cut them into group number one is kind of the digital forensic incident response organizations. And they're usually like the first in with the data. And and they usually do like maybe an MDR, EDR play, or they do other stuff like for customers. But it makes a lot of sense because they're often the ones that say, hey, here's the PST and the business email compromise. Here's what it is. So they might like start the data mining process themselves. So that's like one group. And what's interesting is there's like a divide between this group and then the next group is like, I'll call legal service providers that did review for e-discovery that have now realized that like personal data review, PII review is like kind of close enough, even though it's quite different. And we can get into that later, but it's like quite a different review. And that's interesting. But they realized, well, we have this like ability to like call a bunch of people on short notice and get them looking at documents to make decisions. So they're a group of people that use our software. And then there's like two other groups that use our software, but they're like more influencers. So like law firms, they kind of benefit from our software because they're ultimately who you get the list to usually. And they're usually orchestrating everything for privilege reasons. I would say they mostly are not direct users of our software because they're not usually directly logging into Canopy. They just want the results and kind of want to hear how it's going. But like in kind of like... And by the way, this is across geographies, sometimes in the US, sometimes in Australia, sometimes in other places, sometimes the law firm will be in there. And then the weird ultimate end beneficiary of our software, the people that were actually like benefiting the most is like the insurance companies and to a degree the insured. So like, because ultimately, if you like wanted to define like what's Canopy doing, it's ultimately like saving insurance companies and other corporations money on data mining. That's ultimately what we're doing. But insurance companies largely are not logging into our software either. So it's kind of an interesting, like, they benefit the most from it, but they're not, in there. But those first two groups, the IR groups, and then the legal service providers who now do this other kind of review, they often partner up too, as you've probably seen in the space too.
Okay. Well, I guess, So you did mention something about, e-discovery versus data breach response. What would you consider the differences or similarities between the two of them?
It's one of those things where at 30,000 feet, they look really similar. Because at 30,000 feet, you're technically, like, if you think about both spaces, you technically have some like raw data, like a PST or a bunch of files from a file share. So you have this data, and then you have to like normalize it, which oftentimes people call processing, but you got to get it to where you can like search and interact with it. You've got to like ideally reduce the data set to the relevant stuff. You've got to make decisions on it. And then a deliverable comes out. So at 30,000 feet, those two things sound similar. But if you think about it, in e-discovery, the deliverable is like responsive documents. Like if you think of the like two pharmaceutical companies are suing each other, and one has the brand name and the other has the generic. And there's like one has an obligation to look at those documents and say, is this legally relevant? And then I have to give it to the other side. So the things that they process the data. And then what they cull it on, what they reduce the data set on is like dates, keywords, and custodians. So dates, because there's like the dates through which we're having this dispute, like, oh, we started developing this in like March of 2017. So that's the date, like that matters. And then like keywords, because like there might be code words that are involved. And then people, like the C-suite was making decisions, so we care about their data. Whereas in PII and data mining, we care about like human beings and personal data, and that's kind of it. It doesn't, if you have somebody's social security number, it doesn't matter if it's from 2008 or 2018, it's still a social security number. And that's still the thing, right? So like dates, keywords, and custodians don't matter. The review is different. If you think about like now, like, so the culling is like on different dimensions. The review, you look at a document, and in that like pharmaceutical example where it's like the brand name and the generic, you might get a customer list and have a list of like 30,000 names. There are potential customers of the drugs and all their information. So in an e-discovery case, you just say, oh, responsive, and you're on to the next document. That's relevant. They should know, who are we trying to sell to? In our world, it's like, hey, there's like names and addresses and credit card numbers. And this is a big deal. Like my work has just begun. Sure, it's relevant. So like you're really, and this is why I always wondered, like, I sometimes wonder, why is it called data mining? I think it's because you're like enriching, making connections within the data is like my best guess at it so far.
Okay.
But I think because like you have to like stitch all that information together. It's not like an outside legal determination. It's not like this is relevant legally. It's that's the social security number and that's the person's name. So the review is different. And then you have this like final piece that is like the entity management, where like you might have somebody's name in there like 30 different times because you found them in this spreadsheet and in this email and in this Word document and in this PDF. And like for my last name's Elliot with two L's and two T's, but people spell it with one T all the time. And I guarantee you in different data breach response projects that people have had me in, they've had my name wrong with one T, and somebody has to resolve that. Like, is it Elliot with two T's? Is it Elliot with one T? If I move, they have to resolve, well, which address is it? And is it a nickname, like nicknames and maiden names versus married names? So you have all these like things that you have to resolve about people, and none of those exist in e-discovery. Like you're not doing any of that. Like, so there's no like tool for that. But you still want the connection to the document. So even though like Anthony Hess and Anthony Hess's information is what's important, you still want to know what are the 30 documents that your stuff was on. Like, why do they have your data? And sometimes you personally might have questions about that, or the end corporation might. So the deliverable in our world is like, it's kind of funny, but it's like a list of names, right? Like what comes out of the process is just like, here's a list of names, here's their addresses, here's the data. Whereas in e-discovery, it's literally documents. You're producing the documents. So at every step, what's weird about it is there's different every step along the way. When you get like an inch off the ground, you're actually doing a different thing. And it turns out you just need different software to do it.
Well, maybe let me think about that for a moment. Let me switch to another question. So just in terms of, what kind of big challenges do you see day to day, and what could be done better?
I mean, it's it's a super interesting space. So like, there's like the business challenges and the tech challenges. So the business challenges are that there's like, there's because the software that is entrenched now is like not efficient, there's people that benefit from those inefficiencies, right? So like, we ultimately have to tell, we have to tell the story to insurance companies and to law firms to a degree about that efficiency and about saving them money, but it's not, but we don't really sell to them directly either. So that's kind of a weird challenge that we have to tell our story to people that, like, I'll meet with somebody from some insurance company and tell them all about us. And they're like, oh, where do I buy your stuff from? I was like, oh, not from me. And I point them to somebody else. And mm-hmm. and they're like, huh? And I'm like, yeah, we sell to these other organizations. And then, right. So, and then sometimes the insurance company will even be like, well, I really work on the business side, but it's our claims managers who really make these decisions, and they have panel providers. And that's really like so that's like a business challenge of like telling that story and getting them to understand. And yeah. by the way, all those panel providers have entrenched interests to like keep us far, far away, because they're like, they want to keep making more money, like, which I don't begrudge. So that's like the business challenge. And then the tech challenge is interesting. It's like, how do we make this process? It's like an AI space, right? So like,
yeah.
How do we make this review faster? So like, how do we, like, for instance, like a funny, like just funny, interesting stuff is like, it turns out databases come up a lot in our world. So how do you make it easier to review a database? Because databases often have like a ton of PII in them and personal data, and people stash stuff, like people store stuff in them, and they'll just be part of a ransomware attack all the time, but they're really gnarly. So how do you make that easy? That's like the kind of stuff. And how do you, here's another like funny like thing. So say you have a spreadsheet that has a whole bunch of data in it. And then that same data is in a whole bunch of other documents too. How do you cascade that as fast and as easy as possible to a review team? Like, to make that just faster, 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 easier. If I already found this combination of PII and humans, how do I, like, stuff like that? Like, that's like the tech challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess I'm sort of back to thinking about, you know, coming into a space where, you know, people might be, for the automated part of the review, using e-discovery tools.
Yep.
But at the same time, they're almost, it's almost like that became a commoditized space. Everybody started saying, well, you know, because the manual review was so much more expensive, you know, the automatic yep. part was kind of a small piece of that. I think most of the time, sometimes the software get pretty expensive, but it's kind of interesting. You know, the market kind of went in the direction of, right, the automated is a commodity, you know, and then we'll just try to push as much as we can on the price of the manual review. You know, a lot of times by like offshoring it, or maybe clever employment structures, you know, trying to find all these ways to push the prices down. It is interesting. I guess, you know, we've kind of hinted a little bit as to why people may not want to change the way they're doing it from a business perspective, but just technically, why is it that hard? Really? Is it that hard for somebody from a technical perspective to say, right, we're going to go back, we're going to look at automated reviews, we're going to do this yeah. much better than anyone else, and that'll drive down the cost of the manual reviews. Why aren't other people doing that?
A few reasons. So reason number one, like the bigger reason is that the companies that were doing it when we existed were really focused on e-discovery. And if mm-hmm. anything, for a lot of good reasons, because that's, there are like multiple companies fighting over like a multi-billion dollar pie already. Right. Yeah. So like the company I used to work at is like at least their last public valuation was like $3.5 billion or something. And they have a lot of companies coming after them in e-discovery. They have like this other company that went public recently at $1 billion valuation, and like two other companies that are like getting multi-billion dollar valuations. There's been other. So in the e-discovery space, they're like deeply fighting over, there's going to be winners and losers, and how much of that valuation is justified. So thing number one is that they're focused on the thing that they actually do. Yeah. And if people use them for this other use, cool. But like, they have a main thing that they're focusing on, okay. and with good reason, like in the same way that we're not focusing on that problem. And I would say the other reason is that it's a really hard space to get into because it's incredibly insular. And it's right. not, and it's actually not that big a market. Like, so if you can't come at it fresh, like from scratch, mm-hmm. If you think about it, like think of how much everyone knows everyone in the space, how it's not really, it's not as big a space as people think. So like, yeah. It's not, you're not selling to like every corporation on earth. You're really selling to, in a lot of ways, a small number of IR providers and review providers that handle incident response and cyber and this sort of. So like, it's a mix of the e-discovery people are focused on their problem. And by the way, I'm of the, coming from e-discovery, which I think is a really helpful place to come from, I'm kind of the belief that you can't be good at both of these things simultaneously. Like, they're just different.
Okay.
Like the goal of figuring out which documents are responsive legally is different than the goal of identifying a bunch of human beings whose personal data has been compromised. That's just a different goal. And you're not going to be good at both of those things in the same piece of software.
Yeah, maybe I've heard a little bit of technical, but it sounds like it really is mostly business reasons that it's hard.
It's a mix of business. It's the technical part is that it's a different challenge. Like, because like the each phase, and they're all interrelated. Like, one of the big things that people, when they start using our software, that they see is that the process gets compressed. Like, normally, when they're using e-discovery tech, they think of the initial phase of like processing and culling down the data, usually using search terms and regular expressions or something. That's like one phase. And again, it's not very effective, but that's why people don't think about it, because they were all using the same stuff and they all got to like, nah, this is as good as we could get with that. And the tools weren't super good at it, but it led to big data sets, which is good. If you're a review company, then you like the big data set because you're like, all right, I can review more docs. But if you're an insurance company, that actually costs you a lot more. But like, whatever.
Right.
But that thing, there's usually like a big like, and then now a whole separate phase is the review itself. And then a whole separate phase from that is like the entity management and how do I reduce. And for us, like in our world, you could like a project manager might be using our software, and then like day one or two of a project might already be looking at the entity list and tying it back. Like, so all of a sudden things that previously they wouldn't have been doing till weeks later, and it probably would be a different group of people. All of a sudden that's like you review a few spreadsheets on day one and consolidate and see like, what am I really looking at here? It like, it changes the whole workflow and compresses the timeline quite a bit. Which is a lot of technical, like there's benefit that you get.
No, I get it. I get it. It's that there's so much about the problem you're trying to solve that is different, that from a technical perspective, it's just a challenge. You know, all these different things that are different. And if you want to be efficient.
You
know.
And there's so much of where we are now is only because we've chipped away at it since 2018. And like, which is like, that's where people are like, when people are like, oh, this is a commodity, it's solved problems, like, oh man, no way. Our roadmap is like, there's so much for that we're looking at doing still that we have to do, that we actively know, like, all right, there's like all these threads of stuff to do from a technical standpoint, just pure product. And again, but people don't see it because there's nothing that does it yet. They'll see it. Yeah. They see it when we say, hey, here's how you can process a database. And then here's how you can see the tables. They're like, oh. But before you show it to them, it doesn't occur to them that that will exist.
Let me ask this. So it's e-discovery tools. They're sort of, Canopy is the data breach tool. What other things are people using, you know, either from a tool perspective? Let's go that way. Let's go the tools route. I'm enjoying sort of thinking about the technical issues of this. What other parts of the process are people using other things for than e-discovery tools or Canopy?
So the number in this... it kind of shows how disconnected the space is, but when they come to us, sometimes they're thinking in this way, but the PII detection, people get really hung up on PII detection, and there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that does PII detection, right? So like, that are not e-discovery tools either. And the reason they're thinking about it is a separate thing, I would argue, is because e-discovery tools don't really do it. So they'd have to find, so they have to like, they have to make Frankenstein's monster. So when they come to us, like a lot of times they're like, well, we think of like, what's the PII detection versus like, and they'll like have some other thing. And I'm like, that's like, I'll spin it and be like, that would be like thinking of PII detection is the entirety of data breach response is the equivalent of like, there's this tool called DT search that everyone was using in e-discovery from time immemorial. And it'd be like, oh, I'm an e-discovery company because I have DT search. And it's like, nah, you could just have to search from documents, but you still have to like make decisions on them and do all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But I would say the main tools that aren't Canopy are like PII detection, which is like which has its own stuff going on, but it's not for our use case. It's usually for other stuff. Okay. And then here's what's really funny. The entity stuff, spreadsheets, largely spreadsheets or custom databases. So sometimes okay. people would put them all in like a SQL database. And then you have a DBA doing like the incantations of like how you get all these like people. Like, how do you deduplicate a human being? How do you get many Anthony Hesses to a single Anthony Hess?
Doing that in Excel with filters, like that sort of thing.
That's what people are doing when they come to us. It's either it's a mix of like, it's like Frankenstein's monster. And it's like they think, and to us, it's like one cohesive thing. It's like the you have to think about all of it as an interrelated piece. It's like all stuff that's happening in one fell swoop. It also happens faster, by the way, because think about an e-discovery project. Those things. So when we would measure them all the time about lifetimes of projects, both on the software side and on the services side, and the average is like 18 months. So think about it. Like a project would hang around for 18 months while the two companies like argued about it and got continuances and had delays and negotiated. Because most of the time when companies sue each other, they settle. And most of the time they're like arguing about it, and they're like disclosing documents, and they're just like posturing for the settlement. And our like, so 18 months, that means that the software can like in the processes around the software can take its sweet time, because it's like a hurry. Like you might have like, oh my gosh, we got to get the documents by this Friday, but then it just sits there for like 3 or 4 months and nothing happens. Whereas in our world, the entire project is like 3 or 4 months. Like if that sometimes, you know, like it's fast, like the regulations don't say, take your sweet time and notify people whenever. Yeah, notifications are like, hey, here's your timeline. Go.
It's a great point on timelines and speed. We're usually trying to get through them as quickly as we can. So having to build a lot of tools or, you know, mix and match a lot of stuff wouldn't be something we would have considered. Well, cool. Let me transition then a little bit into, you know, talking about maybe more business side of things, costs, et cetera. You know, what kind of mistakes are you seeing the end customers making? So like the insureds, not necessarily the insurance companies or the companies selecting your tools, but sort of the people who, you know, are having these incidents or having these data breaches. Yep. What kind of mistakes are they making? What are they doing wrong?
It's funny that it's like really human stuff. So like, I would say the number one like gap that I see is they put a lot in security, which is reasonable, like build the walls. They put a lot in like asking people and trainings and surveys, like OneTrust style, like validate that you're doing X and Y and Z. And they say, yes, I'm doing X and Y and Z. And they take the survey and they validate, yes, indeed, I did watch this security video. But what they're not doing is the verification of, are they actually handling data internally like they say they are? Mm-hmm. And here's how you know, because almost every time we have one of these projects, like, and every time, like the company is out of compliance with themselves, like meaning the reason why we're notifying people is because there was PII being handled in a way that is not compliant with what they were attesting to in their OneTrust surveys or whatever it is. And I mean, frankly, if people were, I mean, we have a proactive side and of our software that basically gives the power of like data mining, but like to corporations. And the number one reason they don't buy it is because they don't want the political headache internally of actually dealing with it. Meaning, They and Gartner has told us the same thing, that like that makes total sense to them, and they definitely don't want to deal with it. But what I mean is like they will see that like, yo, sure enough, this tells me what the sales team is doing with the data. But I like the chief privacy officer or the GC will say like, I don't want to argue with them. I don't want to burn a bunch of political clout. Like telling my sales team that they're not managing their data correctly. Like that's, I don't want to like, I'll just send them the survey. I'll send them the training. I'll give them good advice. But the second they know about it, like if the GC actually tangibly knows that there is like PII being handled, now they have to deal like inappropriately. Now they have to deal with it. Like, and they'd rather not know. They'd rather just like, hey, we'll open the insurance claim once Like, I'll hope it doesn't happen. We'll put a lot into security. We'll have MFA. Yeah. We'll do all this stuff. But if it happens, it'll hit our policy.
It's funny, you know, because I run into that, right? Where you have, it's not just that they're holding data that they don't need anymore. It's that they're holding data that's stored in a less secure fashion than how it would be stored today, right? Like today, everybody's encrypting their databases or, yep, you know, whatever, the files, whatever it is. There's all kinds of security measures, but there's always that system sitting somewhere that, you know, is 10 years old, has 10-year-old data, but maybe it's a certain notifiable data or whatever. It's just interesting, especially like on a ransomware attack or whatever, like you see this stuff gets stolen. You're like, oh, well, yeah, if that were on the current version of the software, but that's 4 versions ago. So it's not actually encrypted. And yeah, we've got to do all these notifications, whereas you're not using it. It's not secure, but nobody wanted to deal with it.
You could. It was like they didn't really know it was there, really, truly. If you asked them, they probably wouldn't remember it, not out of nefarious reasons because they don't think about it. Here's another thing too. There's a lot of processes inside of corporations that, especially big corporations, if you think about it, big companies have to exchange data a lot to get things done internally. Just internally, you have to move data around. And there's a lot of processes that involve, I'm going to kick out a spreadsheet from this system over here, and I'm going to have it locally on a file share in our area. Then I'm going to email it to this group over here. Like HR kicks out a spreadsheet and sends it to finance about X and Y and Z. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, that's in the file share of HR. It's in the mailbox of the person who sent it. And it's in the mailbox of maybe the whole distro, and it goes to everybody. So now all of a sudden, that one spreadsheet, if it were compromised, that one spreadsheet is an event. Like that's enough to have to like, and there's just multiply that the amount of processes that corporations have that depend upon just, I have to send information from here to there because all these systems don't talk to each other. And think about it like this, they'd be like, well, we could give the finance team access to this HR software that we're using, but that would cost a lot more money. I'd have to pay for the users and I'll just send them. All they really need is the spreadsheet. And that multiply that times an entire multi-billion-dollar company, and it happens constantly. Mm-hmm. And nobody looks. Nobody looks. Yeah. They have no idea. Well, like, they don't know what's in there. Because every time they look, they're like, holy crap, that was worse than I thought.
Yeah. No, it's hard. You know, I'm horrible at deleting things in email. Because you always want to go back and check and see, like, you know, maybe I need that or whatever. You know, it takes a forcing event to kind of push you into going back and seeing what's there and being like, right, I don't really need this. Let's delete this. Let's delete that.
But it's also like this overlay of personal data is different. Like, it's like, it's one thing to like, it's one thing to need like a certain PowerPoint presentation that might have had how you were thinking about a thing at a time. That's no big deal. Who cares? But anything that has other people's personal data on it is like a whole different world. Like, I'll tell you, like, here's just another funny thing is when we run background checks on people now, I would say 10 years ago, we would file the background check in their folder and it would be a record of it. Now we don't export it anymore. Like we leave it there. We file the background. We do the background check on like Canopy employees, but we don't export it. Cause we're like, we don't want to take the hit on PI. We're not like, we don't want that data. And what that means, like when the ISO auditor has to, like ISO comes in and they audit you, right? So they have like, and part of like, so they have to see that you do background checks and they'll like, oh, like they'll at first they'll ask you, oh, upload all your background checks. Like, no, we can't do that. Like I can log in via screen share and I can show you, validate, here's this person's, here's this person's, here's this person's. Like I can screen share with you, but I'm not exporting all that personal data. Like that is not happening. Like we're a smaller company that exists in this space. Like we were founded in the world of data mining and data breach response. So we're like
aware of it.
Privacy first. Yeah.
Yeah.
But think of the big, like the school districts and the medical groups and all these companies that even heavily like, or just the local dentist office, they've existed for like 50 years. It wasn't built in, and to change any process there, had like 30 people have veto power. And it's like a huge headache and nobody wants to do it. And a lot of times, even after they have these events, they beef up the security, but they don't actually change the thing that created the problem in the first place. Like the reason why, like it's easy to like build a bigger wall. It's harder to like change human behavior. it's harder to get people to do things differently inside of a company because it's like systems, and systems are hard to mess with. That's so human, like getting like 30 people to agree to do things differently. And by the way, chief privacy officers, often it's like one person, maybe like three people on their team, and like nobody really reports to them. It's all like they're just like herding cats and trying to get people to agree. So they have to pick their battles too.
Right.
So like that, it's a lot of human stuff, which I totally, I don't think anyone's acting nefariously. It's just incredibly hard to get large groups of human beings to agree on doing things different when they don't directly have an incentive to do it.
Let me kind of change direction a little bit on this. I like to ask people, you know, the metrics, and it's kind of, it gives you a good view on what they're paying attention to. So, what metrics or KPIs are you really interested in? What do you pay a lot of attention to?
Oh man. So like, it's always like the divide between like the internal stuff and the external stuff. Internally, I care a lot about like how satisfied our customers are and how well they feel about the support that they're getting from us across all dimensions, like product and customer success and sales and all that stuff. Obviously as a business, you just like all the regular growth stuff, like how many new projects and what do they look like. I'm a curious human also interested in like how much PII is really in this data, and how does it vary by different types? That's really interesting to that. Yeah. So that's like the internal stuff. The external stuff that's always like way squishier is like what's the actual size of the data breach response market? Like how much is this really truly happening worldwide? That's and the answer is like a lot more than people realize. And obviously, though, with like a funny thing that like impacted by Vladimir Putin, weirdly, but okay. So like how much is it happening? How many projects there's a bunch of projects that never become projects that all ever end up in metrics because people just don't talk about. They go in the drawer, you know, they just get put away. And sometimes you hear about them. Like I've seen a few of them, but.
So you mean how many people just like. They spin something up. They're supposed to be doing notifications, and instead they just kind of go, right, well, okay, yeah, we're going to not notify anybody of this.
Okay. Yeah, that happens from time to time, like for a variety of reasons, because it's all like legal risk that they're assuming one way or the other, and they like make a calculation and whatever. It's a calculation, I guess. But that's like a thing that, and I think that actually things, I would guess that a huge number of these projects don't even get to that point. They just get put in the drawer way before that happens. They deal with the threat actor and they like, but that's, they don't actually like, but they don't,
they get don't even the get to the point of spinning up, reviewing you what the it. Data was. Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
So people like me and you just never find out. Like I bet we've been in many, many, many compromise, like hacks and breaches that we just never heard about, but our data is out there and we didn't know it and stuff like that. Absolutely. So like, in like, like what's the nature of Australia versus like in this market versus so KPI wise, like the various geographies and how the TikTok between the regulatory climate and what we see there. And that's really interesting.
Yeah.
What percentage? Another big one is like, what percentage of a compromise event is data mining / data breach response? Like the thing that our customers like deal with, like what percentage is the part? And we found a lot of times it's like top three. Some like usually it's a mix between you got to pay the ransom or something, or you don't gotta, but they do. Like, so the ransom is like one fee. The remediation is another fee. The business lost is like another kind of cost in there.
Yeah.
And then the data mining is like in there as well. Like that process of like getting people notified. So that's what we found is it's usually top three, and sometimes it's two or one, depending if it's big enough.
Yeah, I'm guessing with attackers stealing the data more often, but at the same time, the companies are more prepared. So the resilience is better. The business interruption is less. Maybe they don't pay the ransom. Kind of feel like the sort of data costs are probably creeping back up to, you know, top of the list again, because it wasn't before, right? It was BI. It was ransoms.
Yep.
But I could see that changing because you're already seeing, you know, I've seen things published out there where analysis being done where the ransom payments are not happening as frequently as they were before. I mean, forget the, you know, a lot of conversations that I've been hearing lately around the volume of ransomware cases, you know, coming in or not. Taking that apart, you know, of those ransomware cases, are people paying? And that seems to be declining.
Yeah.
So then it's just going to be a notification problem again, just like the theft used to be. So,
and I mean, like a funny meta way, like when I like the cocktail party explanation. Yeah. Is if you really want to like back up to like to make a sandwich, you first have to like create the universe, like level thinking, like the reason Canopy exists is to make insurance, like to cyber policy premiums go down, like in a weird way. Like that's our entire goal as a company is to make cyber premiums less by reducing the part of the process that we do, like reducing the cost there. And then that makes business more doable. Because like all of a sudden we all have to pay less on these cyber premium over time. If we can ultimately make the cyber premiums go down, then that's a win for every business. It's a less tax on business.
Yeah.
Cause that's all of this stuff like right now, I think it's a tax on business. It's not going away because we play in the space, but then we all have to have cyber insurance also. And it's non-trivial.
No, that's right. I think, you know, and I've always said this, I think, you know, being as efficient as we can in helping with these claims makes a big difference to the industry, because it does nothing. It all feeds back, you know, and if the costs get really high over here, it feeds back into premiums going up, which feeds back into, it's lower sales and then, you know, less people are using the insurance or less people are. I mean, it drives costs everywhere, you know, across the whole system.
It's wild. Like for us, how like the lead time, like from one, like it's a funny thing to explain that to like an insurance company and that hey, things are changing. Like we're like, there wasn't like blah, 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 blah. Like we explain our story and they're like, oh, we're going to buy your software. Oh, talk to these people. Nah, they're not on our panel. Yeah. And then one of the times they're like, oh man, maybe we could get one of our panel providers to have your software. And they're like, oh, they just raised the price and make us pay the same thing. Can't do that. So they had to like add two candidates. Yeah. Like they themselves, like those are the strategy people from the insurance company realized if they would have put one of the panel providers, this made them have they just raised the prices to be the same price. And so they were like, they're like, all right. So then they had to add like different Canopy providers who would like save them money. But it was weird that they even can't talk to themselves about it.
There's, it's a whole different conversation. We'll have to have that one. We'll have to have that one at some point where, you know, sort of the bigger the IR provider, the risk you have and the pressure you have to kind of, or just consultancy, any services organization, like if it gets bigger, you know, they get better at certain things, but what gets harder is it gets harder to have efficient, small, like cost saving. Cause all of a sudden, like all the pressure is going to be more and more revenue, like the internal pressure. It's like revenue, revenue. And then you're like, but you know, I can disrupt this. I can come in at half the cost or whatever, but those individuals in that company aren't going to see a benefit doing that.
Not only that, they can't a way, because think of it like this. There are people who lead the cyber business unit at these groups that are using less efficient technology. And frankly, they've told me straight up, if I went to my CEO and said, what if we did the same number of projects next year, but we charge less for it? And he'd be like, I'd be fired. Like, I can't say that. Like, I can't, like, I have to. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to try and like, I'm going to go like, all right, I'm going to tell the story. I'm going to use this as an anecdote, but.
Yeah. It's definitely not all companies are like that. Like I have been.
Oh, for sure.
You know, one of my previous really large employers did something. I don't want to call them out, but they did something pretty clever. And I think they were able to make a good argument internally for, you know, let's do this the most efficient way we can. So it's not always going to be that way, but I think there's a natural pressure. You know, I mean, I guess I never felt, you know, maybe it's so strong of, you know, you might lose your job kind of thing, but it's more like, well, if you're being measured on revenue and you've just found a way to cut your revenue by a quarter, like that's kind of a scary thing because all of a sudden you're not hitting targets anymore. So all these,
here's the other thing. You've hired people, you have a whole group of people that work for your company based on that revenue that you're currently doing. Think of that as a CEO, like, or a head of a business unit. You're like, I'd have to change my staffing quite a bit. Those are real people. Those are friends. Those are people that I like and know. And If I wasn't overall, if my top, like if I wasn't making the same amount of revenue and I couldn't maintain, like, yes, it would be good for the insurance company. Although even then, like I could tell you, we've had projects where the, I mean, this is like a wild anecdote, but like the, there was an insurance company, like one of these things happened. It was like a 700 gigabyte project. And the bid from the insurance company and to the insured was like $2.5 million. And their policy was like $5 million. Mm-hmm. And the company freaked because they were like, well, if we're already into this for like $2.3 million, if this is $2.5 million, we're almost out of pocket.
Yeah.
So they like pivoted to a kit, like they like on their own, the actual company did some research and they found like a canopy provider and talked to them. And then the provider brought us in to like be kind of a neutral party and just explain like some of this, like, hey, here's why it is the way it is. And here's why, like, how is this group cheaper? Like that was one of the companies, they wanted me to break it down for them. And so I did. And they went back to their insurance company. I think the canopy provider versus 2.5 was bidding like, I want to say like 500,000 or 600,000 or something like that on the exact same project. Like, and the insurance company objected. They objected because it was non-panel. But then they did the project. Everybody was happy. Like it worked. And like they paid like $2 million less than the initial bid. So you'd think the insurance company would be like, oh, we're going to use this other company now for our panel next time. We're going to get them on the panel immediately because they just saved us, the insurance company, $2 million. Nope. They did not. Like they like had to fight tooth and nail and like they were still on the outs. And if anything, like now again, is every claims manager insurance company like that? No, of course not. But it's wild that they have demonstrable, the bid was 2.5. It came in $2 million less than that, give or take. Yeah. And then they were like, we'll go back to them.
I could see that as maybe companies got bigger, you know, get big, large insurance companies, it gets harder for them to sort of have the freedom to kind of think about how do I reduce costs? Because again, they're you know, they're sort of rules they have to operate under.
They're big companies too, with all these rules and process. And like, again, like that's why people like, it's funny that like this is like true in our industry, but it's also just true generally, is like every time you're like, that's stupid, why is that happening? Just think about humans and their incentives and the system behind it. And it all almost comes like, Why are weird things either politically or inside a business? Every time somebody thinks like, oh, why did like Microsoft do that? That's really stupid. Well, Microsoft's full of smart people. So like, think about their incentive. Like, why would they have done that? Because I promise you, they're not trying to be stupid. And that's like every company everywhere is you get locked in to a way of doing things. And it's just a bunch of people and people have their own internal incentives. And there you go. You're off to the races.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. We got a little bit more we can cover, but we're starting to get close on time. So maybe one more chunky question and a few small ones I like to ask. Current events, what do you like? What's interesting going on out in the world from a cyber perspective right now?
I'll go back to, I guess, a couple things. One, the Optus event in Australia, I think has amped things up even more. I think it was already a more advanced market than people realized, but I think the regulatory climate is getting pretty more aggressive there.
Yeah.
And where I think previously companies above a certain threshold were exempted, I think that might be going away, that kind of makes sense because like, I think if you're going to be handling personal data at all, you need cyber insurance and you need to be able to respond if data is breached. Like me as a human being, no matter what size, I want to know if my data has been compromised. So that makes sense. But I think in the current events world, Optus was particularly interesting. Twitter had a breach recently, or a compromise event, not a breach. I'm not a lawyer, but they had an event and basically apparently like everybody's usernames, email addresses, phone numbers got posted and it looks legit. Like it looks from what everybody's saying. What I'm interested in is it's email addresses and phone numbers and names and their Twitter names. Like what is that? Is that an event? Is that a nothing burger? Like if like for instance, like I'll just like like they picked some high profile, the threat actor picked some high profile people and said, hey, just to prove it, here's some. And like Steph Curry's email address is in there. Like, and again, right. I'm sure he like changes it, but like, you're like, is that a thing? I mean, like, I wouldn't want my personal email address out there, but like, is that going to be ultimately from a regulatory standpoint? Are we going to get, but like lawyers have that information on their public website. You go to any lawyer's website and you can get their name and address. And
you can always find, law firms are the easiest to get
a hold of. Law firms are the easiest. So I'm really interested to see, is this a nothing burger? Because they're getting threatened by it. But it's like, it's really just phone numbers and email. And I don't say just, it's just very different than like social security numbers and credit cards. That's like very much more aggressive.
Although it is funny how, you know, just the changes there. I, you know, in the 90s, it was very easy to look up somebody's address, email, like on directories, like, you know, you'd log into your Unix system at university and look people up in directories.
You wanted you wanted to be out there. It was so easy.
I'm pretty certain. So, you know, one of the places I went to school used a social security number as a login or as a student ID.
Yep.
So you could find their student ID, social security number pretty easily. And then it would do things like use their birth date as the default password. So, I mean, it's funny, you know, I get that this was, you know, 25 years ago, but all of this stuff used to be so public. And so it's just, you know, we create all these laws around it and you're like, well, is that really high risk? This is clearly high risk. This one over here, you know, is an email high risk? Everybody gets phishing emails every day. You know, everybody's emails out there.
Yep. And they're getting, I mean, they're getting really good. Like the phishing emails are getting solid. I mean, I think everybody, there's a really interesting, I want to say it was Wired that wrote a story about, there is this, phishing email that's specific. It's like, piggybacking on the customer experience emails that we all get. So it's saying like, win a Yeti by replying to this like Dick's Sporting Goods. Like, and I've gotten that email. Like they wrote a really interesting story about who's on the other side of it and what it looks like when you get hit by it and how they, it's a really interesting piece on a, it was either Wired or The Verge or something like that, that wrote the story. Okay. It was like super interesting. I'll send it to you if I can find it. But it's like, it was like wild for an actual phishing email that I get all the time. And and why Google can't stop it. Like why hasn't Google found this one yet? And it's like, and weirdly, like thanks to like companies like Qualtrics, we've all been taught to like respond to like customer service, like how good was your customer service? So it actually gets you to do something. It's not like it's an interesting and novel approach that you actually have to do some work to get phished.
Yeah.
Like rate your customer experience.
Yeah. It's, it is hard to tell the difference sometimes between phishing emails and, regular emails. Cool. All right. I got a couple, few rapid fire closing questions I like to ask. How did you originally get into this industry?
It was via, this industry itself, I could shout out True Staffing Partners. There was their CEO is this Jared Kosalia. He staffs for privacy. They're like one of the top staffing companies for privacy. But our like Canopy CEO and founder like was just like looking for someone, I guess, and or just he thought we should meet each other. Like that was really how it started. Is he played matchmaker. And it was a really good match. Like Ralph Nichols, like a super interesting dude and who I really appreciate working for. And the company was like, I knew about cyber from the outside. And when I worked for Epic, I led strategy for the e-discovery business, but I knew about the notification business. So like, I had friends over there, so they had a notification business. So I'd like, so that was like, the simple answer is like the, Jared Kosalia, like played matchmaker for me and Ralph. The more complicated answer is, a friend of a friend of a friend worked at Relativity, then called Kekira, now the biggest e-discovery company in the world. And they were a consulting company trying to become a software company. Because at the time they only did service, like they did consulting engagements and they wanted to be a software company with Relativity. And they were like, hey, you should talk to me. Like this friend of a friend of a friend was like, hey, this guy does marketing. So I like created and founded and their marketing team and just fell into it there. Like I didn't know what e-discovery was at the time. So happenstance, complete happenstance. Yeah.
So what would you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career kind of in this industry that we operate in?
I think it's general stuff. Like having a successful career, I would say get really good at communicating your ideas in simple ways. Like I would say communication is like a superpower in my mind. And like be able to write very effective emails. Like one of my favorite sayings is like, I'm sorry, my email was so long. I didn't have time to make it shorter.
Yeah.
Get really good at communicating a lot of high impact stuff in like 3 or 4 sentences, or if that.
It's horrible though. You know which time it takes me? Like, you know, if you get a short email from me, I probably agonized over it for an hour.
Uh-huh. That's the thing.
What did you do today?
Wrote an email. Like, good community. People who can communicate effectively. Simple bullets. What's the action items here? Is there a question? Yeah. Like, oh man, one of my pet peeves is like when people ask the implied question, like we're in, like if you have a question, put a sentence with a question mark at the end of it. That's how you ask a question. You don't like kind of infer the, if you like, whatever, if there's nothing for me to respond, like whatever. So like communicate very effectively, work well with other people, understand what the mission of your company is. Like it's like the stuff of anywhere, because like, I think a lot, like, the nuts and bolts of a successful career are really just like working well with other people, communicating really well, asking good questions, being somebody that people want to work with. Like it's the same as like, right? Like, cause every day you're going to like see these people. So do you want to work with these people? Like, do you want to like, and not that everyone has to be the same, quite the opposite, but just, are you the sort of person that like brings something to the table and is part of the bigger mission? Like this anecdote, this is like an NBA anecdote, which I'm a big fan of the NBA, but somebody said a lot of the reason why people from the G League, like their development league, don't make it in the NBA is because they like get on the NBA roster and the team wants them to be the janitor, but the person wants to be the CEO. Like they think, I want to be like Damian Lillard, and like they don't need another Damian Lillard. They already got a Damian Lillard. Like we just need you to hit a 3-pointer in the corner and play defense, and that's it. Like do one of the, don't dribble the ball too much. Don't like get fancy. And like, especially people like new in their careers, or like they don't realize, like just be part of the bigger picture, man. Just fit in some, like figure out how you can be like, it's, and it's amazing when you find people who are awesome, you know, it so fast, you know, oh, these people are awesome. Like, and it's rare, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Communicate really well. It's not a glamorous answer, but it's like people don't do it. People communicate terribly.
It's a tough question. I like to see what different folks think. Well, cool. Well, it was a pleasure having you on. We're kind of coming out of time, but yeah, thanks a lot for coming and chatting with me. I think it was really educational.
Ah, my pleasure. You're at conferences. You're one of my favorite people to talk to because it's always so tangible and interesting.
If you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.